Right, our pawb yn croeso i digwyddiad heddiw. My name's Auriel Miller. Welcome to today's event. I'm the director of the RWA, the Institute of Welsh Affairs, and it's really great to see so many RWA members and friends joining us online here today. For those of you who don't yet know us, we're Wales's leading independent think tank with a long track record of shaping debates and influencing change in Wales through our policy research and advocacy, our online and print publications, which provide platforms for robust comment and debate, and our agenda setting events. We're politically independent and we don't represent a particular sector, trade or interest group. Instead, we seek to bridge policy and institutional divides and show what might be possible when we work together differently, seeking consensus where possible and robustly challenging the status quo when we need to. We're especially interested in identifying and facilitating long-term change on issues that will make a difference to Wales's economy and democracy. And most importantly, we're a membership organisation with nearly 1,000 members across Wales, the UK and the rest of the world. So if it's your first time at an IWA event, we hope you'll join us as a member and support our work. Diolch. Today's the first in a series of new events, Wales, a Work in Progress. It's a series that will explore the key debates around the constitutional and democratic future of the nation. In these discussions, we're going to be unpicking the options open to us as we look to the nation's future on a diverse set of issues such as transport, social security, devolution settlements across the UK, and mainstreaming deliberative democratic methods. In keeping with our independence, we don't take a position on Wales's constitutional future. Instead, we want to give voice to different options and openly examine the evidence to understand what might be the best path for Wales and why, so that people in Wales can make their own minds up. Our role is to convene these important conversations and unpick the evidence presented. These events also accompany our ongoing podcast of the same name. You can find more information on that on our website, iwa.wales. And the Constitutional Futures Project is kindly supported by the Legal Education Foundation. So a little bit of housekeeping. We always encourage you to introduce yourselves and engage with each other in the chat. Do say hello. We've got people joining us from the UK Parliament, from Welsh and UK governments, from the Senedd, from the Office of the Future Generations Commissioner for Wales, from Invest Local Trust, Audit Wales, DWP, Barnardo's, lots of universities and the Federation of Small Businesses. Do please share your email if you're willing to be contacted by other attendees. We'll do Q&A via the function on Zoom, so get thinking about your questions now. There'll be plenty of time as usual for Q&A. Please remember that the event, all chat and questions are being recorded and will finish promptly at midday. And if you want to tweet, you can at us at @IWA_Wales and we suggest using the hashtag Wales in Progress. Video and audio of today's events will be made available via our YouTube channels and our podcast channel. Now, on to business, the topic at hand, our guest and why you're all here. Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland each have unique devolution settlements with the UK government. In practice, this can have significant implications, not only for the nation's parliaments and governments, but critically for their people too. In this conversation, we're going to be addressing how Wales's devolution settlement compares with elsewhere in the UK. And importantly, we'll be evaluating how this comparison can inform where Wales goes from here. To examine the settlements, I'm joined by Akash Pan, Programme Director at the Institute for Government, IFG, where he leads the IFG's work on devolution. Akash also sits alongside me as an expert panel member of the Independent Commission on the Constitutional Future of Wales. The experts panel role is to provide and assess evidence supplied to the Commission on which the commissioners will be making their deliberations. So croeso mawr, Akash, welcome, and thanks very much indeed for taking the time to come and speak to us. We're going to get started with a paper that you wrote that was called The Welsh Devolution Settlement, Comparison with Devolution Elsewhere in the UK. And those of our audience who've got very eagle eyes will have spotted that it was Appendix 9 in the interim report of the Independent Commission, which I have here. And if you haven't read it, it's a good read. So could you talk us through that? Well done, snap. Could you talk us through that paper, please? And I'm going to hand over to you for the next sort of 5-10 minutes.
Sure. Okay. Well, yeah, thank you, Auriel. Thanks a lot for the invitation to take part in this and to speak to what sounds like a very well-informed and important audience from across the UK, which is great. So, just in terms of introduction, Auriel's already said a bit about me, so I don't need to say too much. But yeah, I work at the Institute for Government in London. I lead our research programme on devolution. looking at devolution all across the UK, including within England and to the to devolved nations. Institute for Government as an organisation, for those who are unaware, is a independent cross-party think tank based in Westminster. And we have the mission of trying to improve the effectiveness of government across the UK. So obviously, if there's questions about our wider work or what the IFG does, happy to take those as well. But I'm here, as mentioned, to speak about a piece of work that I did as part of the expert panel that Oriol's mentioned, which has been supporting the work of the Independent Commission on the Constitutional Future of Wales, which will be reporting its, in terms of its final report in the next few months. But as mentioned, produced an interim report about a year ago now, wasn't it? As part of which, I was asked to carry out an analysis comparing the Welsh devolution settlement with the settlements elsewhere in the UK. So I will be talking about what I did, what I found. And then, although this wasn't really part of my brief in carrying out that analysis last year, I think it is interesting to reflect on the reasons for some of those differences, what the explanation is. And then I'm sure people also will be interested in what might happen next, both in terms of, well, the commission itself will be reporting, and I won't obviously be sort of preempting what they might conclude, but more generally, where the different parties are and how this issue might play out in the general election, UK general election, and beyond. So I've already kind of given an overview of what I set out to do and why. So in a nutshell, the task was to identify differences and what in the paper we talk about as gaps in the Welsh devolution settlement. And what I should say is there's no sort of normative or prescriptive element of my analysis. So when I talk about gaps or identify differences, that is entirely separate from the question of whether those additional powers should be devolved or whether the Welsh settlement should be brought more into line with Scotland or indeed Northern Ireland. But the point of it, of course, was to inform the work of the Commission and its consideration of what potential reforms to make. And yeah, there's no recommendations that I make myself. Obviously, I might have views on some of it, but that wasn't within the paper. So how did I go about this? Well, there were two main ways that I went about making this this comparison between the devolution settlements. First of all, I looked at the underlying devolution statutes, which set out in great detail the powers that are, in fact, not devolved. So I'm sure many of you will be aware, for all of the three nations now, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, we have a reserved powers model of devolution, whereby the legislation, so Scotland Act 1998, Northern Ireland Act 1998, and then Government of Wales Act 2006, as amended subsequently by Wales Act 2017, has in an annex or a schedule to the legislation a long list of things that are not devolved, that are reserved to Westminster. Anything not listed there is by default therefore devolved in the case of Wales in terms of legislative competence to Senedd Cymru, and then separately executive powers devolved or conferred upon Welsh ministers. So I do look through the sort of legal lens, but then what I also do, and actually probably more of the analysis is based on reference and analysis of Treasury spending data, which sets out in quite a lot of detail, specifically in a document produced alongside the spending review, each spending review called the Statement of Funding Policy, not just by department, but at a program level, line by line level within each Whitehall department, which elements of government spending and which public services and functions therefore are devolved to each of the three nations. So it's quite a useful lens through which to understand the contours of the devolution settlement. In terms of the legislative lens, if you like, I think the general point that I would make is, well, as I've already said, what the legislation does is to list what is not devolved, what is reserved. There's a long list. It's Schedule 7, isn't it, of the Government of Wales Act, I think now. Anyway, they're similar for Scotland and Northern Ireland. So, there's a long list of matters that are listed as reserved. Sometimes it's fairly straightforward. Here's an example that you won't be surprised to see. Defence as a function is fully and unambiguously reserved to Westminster. So if the Welsh Parliament were to try and legislate to set up its own army, you won't be surprised that that would be struck down in court pretty swiftly, or it wouldn't even reach that point. But, you know, there's some things that are quite straightforward. There are other areas where the settlement is quite complicated. In some areas, it's grown more complicated over time due to incremental tweaks and changes here and there. This is where people might talk about the jagged edges of the devolution settlement, where the intersection between reserved and devolved powers is quite messy and intertwined, which can make it hard both to govern in that context when the powers are split. And also it can make it hard legally to know sometimes where the legislation, which side of the line it might fall on. And there have, of course, been a number of legal cases over the years, most frequently in regard to Welsh legislation, referred to the Supreme Court to determine whether legislation is inside or outside of legislative competence. Anyway, here's an example of a more complex area where there's a general reservation of tribunals, legal tribunals. That's listed as a reserve matter. However, there's an exception to that reservation for tribunals that only operate in relation to devolved matters and relate to Wales. But then there's even an exception to that exception. So certain elements of the procedure are still reserved. Anyway, it's just an example of how the settlement can be quite complicated. And to go back to my task in making the comparison between Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland, that meant it is sometimes quite hard to work out exactly what the differences are. We don't have a single devolution statute, as some people might advocate, a single piece of legislation that sets out how devolution works all across the UK. Obviously, there's advocates of a sort of written constitution or just codification in other ways that might take us in that direction. But at the moment, we have three quite different settlements. So comparison is complex. Anyway, so that's the sort of legislative side. Moving on to, as I say, in a way, what I relied more upon in the analysis was using Treasury data to figure out the differences between the settlements. So this is just a little screen grab from a little bit... one section of the document I mentioned, the statement, statement of funding policy, which lists at that detailed program level for each government department, whether any given line of spending is devolved to Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland. So this is just part of the list. You can see it only goes A to B because it's a long, long list of items. So you can really get into the weeds and detail of devolution through this document if you are interested to do so. And what this table shows is, well, first of all, you've got the amount of money allocated to each function. Obviously, that's in thousands of pounds. And then you've got for each of the three nations, you've got a categorization of either it is devolved, 100% means it is devolved, or 0% means it is not devolved, it's a reserve matter. So here, for example, under transport air accident investigation, that's not devolved to any of the three nations, 0%. Bus service operator grants, that is devolved to all three nations. That's why it's categorized as 100%. But sometimes, of course, it is more complicated and you have the differences between the settlements. So British Transport Police devolved to Scotland and Northern Ireland, but not to Wales. Not surprising, probably, to people who are aware, obviously, that policing in general is devolved to the other nations, but not to Wales. And there are, in the longer list, examples of things that are devolved to Scotland and Wales, but not to Northern Ireland. Only to Northern Ireland. There's all sorts of intricacies there. Also, just as a note, there's a negative sign there, so that's a revenue generating program, something to do with air travel insurance scheme. Anyway, so that's the useful lens through which I kind of did this analysis, and I won't go into this in detail, but the point of the reason the Treasury collects and presents this data in this way is because it is the underpinning basis of calculations for the Barnett formula. So that determines whenever there are changes in government spending through the Barnett consequential effect, whether or not a particular program is devolved determines whether additional money is given to the devolved government. So there's just a worked example there. If NHS England were to be given £100 extra, well, first of all, that's just a drop in the bucket for NHS England, but just as an example, Wales would get 6 million additional funding. The Welsh government would have 6 million added to its block grant, reflecting the Welsh population as a proportion of England, plus a 5% bonus that Wales gets through a fair funding formula negotiated as part of the fiscal framework. Anyway, so that's what the data is used for. And then at spending reviews, in addition to the line by line presentation I showed you, the data is also aggregated at the departmental level. And that's when it starts to become, you know, a really kind of useful way to see at a glance the difference between the three devolution settlements. So here are the however many departments listed there, all the main Whitehall spending departments at the time of the spending review. There have been machinery of government changes since then, particularly BEIS, people will be aware, has been split. But most of the other departments are unchanged. And so this shows across the entirety of departmental spending on public services, how much of the activity of each department is devolved. And so at the top, you've got pretty much fully devolved departments, at least in terms of their spending responsibilities. And this is a point I make in the paper. Obviously, not everything government does is to do with public spending. And that's why thinking about the legislation and the regulatory powers and so on at the same time is important to give that richer picture. But this is quite a useful sort of slightly simplified overview of what is devolved and what is not. So, yeah, education, what is now DLUHC is listed still there as housing, communities and local government, but the functions haven't changed. Health and social care, they're basically entirely devolved. And then you've got a range of spectrum of other departments. And just at a quick glance, it's very obvious where the gaps in the Welsh settlement are likely to be found. You can see in transport, nearly all the spending, not all, but nearly all the spending of the DFT is devolved to Scotland and Northern Ireland, but only 37% of it is devolved to Wales. And that's primarily because of rail transport, rail travel being an England and Wales matter, so not devolved. The devolved elements are buses and roads and local transport like that. But rail transport accounts for a big chunk of spending from DFT, and you can see the difference there. There are small differences. I'll come on to some of the nuances in a minute, actually, for example, in DCMS. But the other and work and pension, certainly as well. The other big area, again, hardly a shock to anyone who knows the basics of devolution. The other big area of difference is in justice and home affairs. So justice is fully devolved to Scotland and Northern Ireland, and aside from those tribunals and some other minor functions, is not devolved at all to Wales. And similarly, under Home Office, it's police, that expenditure, police and crime reduction, that's the bulk of spending through the Home Office. And that's why 3/4 of Home Office spending is devolved to Scotland and Northern Ireland. Obviously not stuff like immigration, border control, counter-terrorism, but the core of policing, and not devolved to Wales. Work and pensions, again, a big difference. The entirety of the social security system is, technically speaking, devolved to Northern Ireland, albeit in policy terms, Northern Ireland mostly just replicates UK or GB, I should say, spending, DWP policy, and is funded accordingly. So that's a bit of a devolution in name only, but there is some flexibility about administration of the system. Scotland does have some genuine devolution of certain benefits, which is why 20% of DWP spending is classed as devolved to Scotland, but not to Wales. So those are kind of the main differences that really stand out from that table. I won't go through this in detail because I've already drawn out the key points. But what I would just also note from the analysis is there are some other interesting differences that aren't immediately apparent from that high level analysis. So one thing that I think, you know, the commission, the Constitutional Commission, but others in Wales certainly might pay attention to and highlight, is there are some functions that in some, you could argue, are devolved within England, for particularly to Greater Manchester, to London, but not to Wales. So, for example, administration and a strategic role in allocating shared prosperity and levelling up funding. That's something that the UK government has bypassed the Welsh government, and indeed Scottish government too, in using that money while working more in partnership with, say, Greater Manchester Combined Authority and local government elsewhere in England. Also on policing and justice, even Andy Burnham, Mayor of Greater Manchester, or indeed Sadiq Khan, Mayor of London, they have responsibility for policing, and that they've taken on the Police and Crime Commissioner functions, and indeed Tracy Graben in West Yorkshire as well. Whereas that's obviously not something that's devolved to the Welsh government, albeit there are PCCs in Wales, but that's a sort of Home Office sort of imposition, actually, legislatively speaking. So there's some interesting differences there. There's other elements. When you go through the detail, you spot all these individual small things that for one reason and another are devolved to the other nations. There's a few I just noted: Ofwat, the National Archives, abortion policy, the ability to refer matters to the Competition and Markets Authority, which Scottish ministers can do. Funding of the Green Deal is devolved to Northern Ireland. Gender reform policy in the news at the moment. So there's lots of little differences there, detail in the paper. And then there's also quite an interesting difference between both Scotland and Wales on the one hand and Northern Ireland on the other in the constitutional status of devolution. And that's very much something that the commission is interested in and thinking about. And, you know, Welsh government has made recommendations in the past about entrenchment and so on. But in the case of Northern Ireland, for example, there is a statutory recognition of the right to self-determination of the people of Ireland as a whole, a statutory right in certain circumstances to hold a referendum on leaving the UK and reunifying with Ireland. That doesn't exist for Scotland and Wales, and that reflects, well, lots of things, but the history of the peace process in Northern Ireland, the treaty that underpinned it, including with the Republic of Ireland. But is that's just another element of the asymmetry of the settlements. So that's sort of some of the high level results. I said I would talk a bit about the explanation for this. I don't want to take up too much more of your time. I was just thinking there's many ways that you can approach this, and people could and probably have written PhDs on why Welsh devolution is different in various respects to the other settlements. I think a full explanation would refer to those four big topics that I've listed there, those four kind of A-level subjects, if you like. Some of it is just history and path dependence in terms of what was administratively devolved pre-1999. So to take an obvious example, Scotland's had its own legal jurisdiction and legal system as a whole since ever, basically. It was never integrated into an English jurisdiction in the way Wales was. So that's a sort of path dependence, historical reason. Geography explains some of it, particularly with Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland has a lot of power, for example, more power than Scotland, certainly over its energy system. Well, that's because it's not part of the same grid, or railways. That's because it's not the same part of the same railway network. So there's kind of things like that, as well as geographical factors to do with Wales's proximity to greater proximity in terms of everyday, you know, economic and public service interaction with England than across the Anglo-Scottish border. So we know that's, you know, makes it in some respects a bigger challenge to separate Wales because there's so much cross-border movement in all respects. And that relates to the economic point as well. But also there's arguments around, would Wales necessarily want to take on some of the responsibilities for, say, taxation and welfare that Scotland has taken, given that with those opportunities to do things differently come risks, and Wales is poorer on average than Scotland and obviously England. And then sometimes the differences are purely political negotiations between Scottish government and UK government after the 2014 referendum led to changes that weren't necessarily replicated for Wales, for example. So there's all sorts of explanations. I think I will stop there and we can delve into the wider politics of it in conversation if you like. But yeah, hopefully that's given a good overview of the work I did and my take on where Wales sits in comparison to the rest of the UK.
Great. Thanks very much indeed, Akash. So if you stop sharing your screen,
yeah, will do.
Pick it up from there. Brilliant. So I think one of the things I've noticed in terms of the work that we've been doing on the expert panel is everybody often has a very detailed view of their own specific area of what's devolved in the area that which they work on, but not necessarily that comparison across the UK. And obviously with the changing devolution settlements in English regions, you know, the situation is and the context is changing all the time. So I'm just wondering, you know, do you think that further calls for further devolution of powers in England, do you think that makes wider constitutional change an easier ask of central government? Just because it's being talked about.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, yeah, devolution, decentralization within England has always been treated separately and within UK government. And I think, you know, usually within wider kind of policy debates and policy world as well. And essentially, English devolution is not typically thought of as a constitutional matter. I think perhaps that is starting to change, but there is still, I think, a view in Whitehall Westminster that English devolution is more of a delegation of functions to, you know, this is slightly overstating it, and this is not how government would talk about it, but, you know, local government or devolved entities that are treated almost as delivery agents for central government. I think we are, and whereas, you know, with Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, there's much more of a recognition that, well, in the first place, these are nations they have earned or and voted for through referendums, you know, a degree of devolved autonomy, and
there are parliaments to scrutinise.
Indeed, yeah, there's parliaments, exactly. It's a
part
whole
of the issue then that people have different understanding of what devolution as a word actually means in different places.
Yeah, I think so. I think it is used. I mean, even, you know, I was saying people talked about administrative devolution even pre-1999, which basically just meant you had, you know, UK ministers sitting in Cardiff and Edinburgh part of the week, but still part of a single government. So yeah, it is used to mean different things. I mean, but as I was saying, I do think with English devolution, it's messy It's very, is, you know, different places have moved very much at different speeds. Some places have no devolution at all. You've got places like Greater Manchester that are forging ahead. I think gradually, incrementally, we might be moving towards, a sort of convergence between English devolution and devolution to the nations. We're nowhere near that yet. But I think, for example, if you look at the, and to directly answer your question, I think if we, the closer we get to that point, I think it's, well, what does it mean for Wales? I mean, I think there's an argument that then if Wales ends up being just treated like another English region, that might not be, that might not be good, and it might encourage government, central government, to unpick elements of devolution or interfere more in devolved areas. On the other hand, I think over time it might enable us to have a bit more of a rounded conversation about the territorial constitution of the UK as a whole, because we've just had, well, throughout, you know, decades of devolution, these very separate debates and, you know, processes and legislation and so on in each part of the UK, and it has led to something quite messy and
a very piecemeal approach that is quite opaque to lots of people, I think.
And as I was saying, there are, you know, sometimes there's good reasons why we've places have ended up in different locations, and I'm not naive to think that any government could or should quickly move to, you know, a sort of uniform federal settlement for the whole UK, dividing England into regions and so on. I mean, I think there's loads of reasons why that wouldn't work, but moving towards something a bit more systematic and consistent and principle driven, I think would be helpful.
And I think that's the point of the work of the Independent Commission, isn't it?
Yeah.
To sort of set out what those options are, you know, and the three options already identified in terms of entrenched and enhanced devolution, federalism and independence, and the pros and cons of each of those options as against the pressure points that have been already identified through the evidence submitted a year ago, and against, you know, looking forward into the future, what are the potential scenarios that would happen? We're not going to get too far ahead of us on that, though. We're just going to stick with, is there anything that's particularly changed since you did this analysis a year ago? And, you know, or any new developments from that perspective?
Well, I mean, I suppose nothing, there's been no formal, like, reform of the devolution settlements, obviously, since then. We've had some interesting recommendations made. For example, the Brown Commission on the Future of the UK, which very much was, I mean, there's, I don't know, people may or may not have read it, but that was the commission set up by Keir Starmer and led by Gordon Brown to develop recommendations for constitutional reform across the UK. And I mean, there's a lot of interesting things in there. I don't think half of it will happen, but but there are sort of those proposals around entrenchment and how you might give somehow greater protection and certainty to Welsh devolution, Scottish devolution, and the institutions, that their powers won't be taken away, or there won't be legislation passed in devolved areas without consent, which has obviously happened more frequently in recent years post Brexit.
And this brings us on to intergovernmental relations, doesn't it, before we just open out to Q&A, because if the mix of devolution settlements is a really piecemeal kind of jigsaw and no great clarity to others to sort of see what the whole picture is, I won't extend the analogy too much further, that makes intergovernmental relations quite difficult sometimes in some instances because of the differing settlements in different places. Now, there have been some reforms to IGR since 2022, when Lord Dunlop published those recommendations. And, you know, a mixed picture, I think, in terms of progress since then. What's your view on that from where, I mean, we see from, obviously, from a sort of Wales and Westminster perspective, what do you see from a UK-wide perspective?
Yeah, so there was the Dunlop review, that's right. And then sort of separately or in parallel with that was the four governments jointly ran the Review of Intergovernmental Relations that reported at the beginning of
2022,
wasn't it? Yeah, certainly getting my years confused. Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, I think that review and the new system that it put in place, which for those unaware consists of a more systematic structure of intergovernmental committees that are set up in three tiers. So you're supposed to have annual, there's only been one so far, we'll see if another one happens soon, but there's supposed to be annual sort of summit meetings, at least annual summit meetings between prime minister and the first ministers and other senior figures. Then you've got a sort of middle tier with a more strategic oversight of the, there's one committee to do sort of oversight of the intergovernmental system, and there's one committee to do fiscal stuff. And then you're supposed to have committees or interministerial groups at departmental level. And then there's a sort of system of dispute resolution. Things can be referred up the levels. There's a more transparent approach to reporting on all this stuff. There's an independent secretariat to support all the committees and run the dispute process and so on. So I think, yeah, I mean, all of that we thought when it came out was sensible. It was addressing some of the weaknesses of the previous system, in which basically UK government could engage with the devolved governments sort of at their own discretion, as and when it suited ministers. Meetings often weren't held. Disputes, if they arose, could almost be unilaterally decided upon by UK ministers. So we've moved a bit away from that towards something that feels a bit more like partnership between the nations or between the administrations. I don't think it's made a huge, huge difference in practice. A lot of those committees haven't really been meeting much, but I think it was a move in the right direction.
The early days.
Yeah, absolutely.
Early days.
There's a lot of debate about where you go next. And again, going back to Brown, I mean, he was proposing you'd put some of those things into statute. You'd maybe have legally enforceable dispute processes and that kind of thing.
Okay, let's go to questions. We've got a question from Bethan Davis, who asks, as we progress further into devolved governance across the whole of the UK, how do we engage and educate people about who's responsible for different elements of national, regional and local service delivery, particularly when it's not really very clear cut?
That's challenging to do. I mean, again, it's certainly something. Well, Oriel, you've been much more involved in that side of it than I have, to be honest. But it's so you might want to answer the question. But it is something that, again, the Commission's been thinking about, like making, devolution work or Welsh democracy work shouldn't be looked at just through the lens of the institutions and the powers and the structures. It's absolutely about engagement with civic education, if you like, of voters. And there's no sort of simple fix to that. It is complicated for people who aren't going to be following, the intricacies of constitutional debates to know who's responsible for what, where powers lie. But obviously there's a role for the media. There's a role for, no doubt, schools and education at different levels. There's a role for, events like this, hopefully, with a big audience of how many people are watching. I don't know, Oriel, what other points?
Well, I think it's an interesting one, Beth, and I think it's a really useful question, because it's not like you get an induction to it, do you, at any age, in terms of how does the UK work, what's good about how things are set up and what isn't. I think, one of my bugbears is that it needs to continue across the life course. It's not just something that needs to happen at school and then it's done. Yeah. And I raise this always, but also making sure that decisions are explained clearly in public, and people understand where and how they can get their voices heard. So it's one of the key tenets of the IWA in terms of our work on democracy. Let's move on to a question from Roger, who hasn't given his surname, but going back to basic principles and supposing that we never had any devolution, why would devolution other than at county level be a good idea?
I'm sorry. Is that written in the chat?
It's in the Q&A at the bottom, because it's
Let me
tough,
just
I know, when
read
you're
that. Brilliant.
hearing it for the first time.
Yeah, going back to basic, supposing we had never had any devolution, why would devolution other than at county level be a good idea? So,
That's a big question.
well, it is, yeah. Also, I don't know if Roger's referring to Wales or.
Let's take it for Wales. Let's just
Okay, fine. Because it's a bit like that's a big debate in terms of why devolve to, say, county, sorry, to combined authorities around city regions. Why is it Greater Manchester Combined Authority, not Lancashire Assembly or something like that? And the answer to that is, typically it's about economics, and you try to establish institutions at functional economic level where transport systems, labor markets, housing markets operate. That's the rationale for that, whether you kind of buy that or not. I mean, for Wales, well, I think there's obviously an important argument about the role of local government within Wales. I don't know that I would profess to have a strong view on it, but certainly, people make the argument that devolution to Cardiff has, maybe could be argued to have led to centralization or weakening of local government.
And alongside that, there's also an argument, a relatively widespread consensus, that 22 local authorities is too many. So that we've had three failed attempts at least to reorganize things. Let's move on to a
I
question
mean,
from.
I would just also say, sorry, I mean, the other obvious reason why would you want to devolve to Wales, if that is what the question was asking about, is Wales is a nation that has voted twice to have a parliament and to have institutions at that scale. So
Yeah, definitely.
simple answer, but that's how I see it.
Okay, we've got a question here from Peter Hugh Jenkins, who's asking, every devolved function comes with an administrative cost, and how does that get tabulated? Is there an assumption that the X amount for transport also innately leads to a consequent Y amount for instance, civil servants in Welsh government?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, okay, so in terms of Barnett formula calculations, as I understand it, I'm pretty sure this is right. So, because the way they do it is every line in that document I shared an extract of is either 100% or 0%. That's how they categorize it. Administration costs, you will have seen it actually on that slide because it begins with A, so it was near the top, which is the bit I shared. Administration is categorized in the same way. So for transport, the one I used, what did they call it? They called it 100%. I've just looked back at my slide. You can't see that now, but yeah, so 262 million pounds was the provision for administration of transport, and that has 100% comparability factor under the Barnett system. So yeah, if spending on DfT civil servants increased, then you'd get a Barnett effect. For other departments, you wouldn't, because it would be classed as zero.
Okay. We've got two questions from Jacob Ellis from Future Generations office. Could we have seen some temporary, in inverted commas, new devo powers to Wales during COVID? Is there any precedent for devolution pilots or temporary powers being devolved and then taken back?
Well, new devolution powers to Wales. I mean, I'd be interested in what specific examples or areas Jacob might be thinking about. I mean, obviously, during COVID, a lot of the public health functions were devolved, and didn't the Coronavirus Act, now you're testing my memory, didn't that actually confer, not maybe legislative powers, but it did confer
Regulations, you
some
can make
additional.
regulations, can you?
Yeah, right. So it did, there was some executive devolution or some new, executive powers conferred upon Welsh ministers to act in that emergency situation. So yeah, I guess
That'd be
that
the
did.
only example I could think of in that. Maybe others. on the court might know.
Well, I mean, a big example of a temporary deal is a totally different context, but, you know, the power to hold Scottish independence
Indeed.
referendums was devolved temporarily in 2014 and then expired once used.
And
I don't.
hence the case being made to try and have another one.
Because it wasn't permanently devolved, exactly. So that there are examples of that, indeed.
Okay, another live question at the moment. In about what 18 months ago, we've had a new office for the Crown Estate in Wales being set up for the first time. What views have you got on the devolution of the Crown Estate?
I saw that question. I was hoping you weren't going to ask me about it.
Sorry, I'm gonna get
I don't really have any informed views on that. I apologise, Jacob, and to you. It's not one I've looked into. I mean, I know it was. I remember it being considered during the Smith Commission process that was set up after the Scottish referendum, when other fiscal devolution other devolution took place, including of tax powers. And I don't recall what they even did in Scotland in the end. I genuinely don't know. I'm sorry.
It is devolved in Scotland, and
it is, isn't it? That's
it gets a portion of the profits
yeah,
as well.
Right.
Which goes straight to local authorities. I think off the top of my head, about 11%. I could be wrong, but something like that.
Okay, so it did change at that time. That's what I was trying to remember.
Yeah.
So, okay. And that's one, to be fair, that I missed in my analysis, because maybe to go back to my methodology, I looked at the legislation. I looked at the spending. I didn't look at the sort of royal prerogative side of the constitution. It wasn't picked up, I suppose, in the way I looked at it. But I mean, you know, I think to go back to some of the conversations we had earlier about should there be more consistency, at least in the principles that determine what's devolved, I think, you know, if something has been devolved to Scotland, at least, you know, the government should be willing to explain why the circumstances are different.
UK government,
The UK government.
I want to make sure we get through all these questions. And we've got one from Dr. Paul Worthington, who says really interesting comments on the differences between English devolution and the devolved nation model, especially the description of England's approach as essentially delivery. Is there a more overtly political element to the devolved nation model?
So I mean, I've just first of all to reiterate, I was slightly deliberately overstating the difference, but to make the point, that's sometimes, I think, that historically has been the way that decentralization, devolution in England has been treated. But I do think it is changing, and I think where you've got powerful, high profile mayors in, you know, Greater Manchester and Liverpool and Leeds and Sheffield City regions and places like that, and London for sure, it is becoming a political devolution as well. You know, those people are certainly not delivery agents of central government. I think we're kind of evolving incrementally.
Shifting a bit more, isn't it? Because you could argue certainly in Wales that obviously, you know, any Welsh government's political and policy decisions being enacted is a very different kettle of fish to the delivery of something which is decided by a central government in the UK. And you're seeing from, you know, Wellbeing and Future Gens, we're seeing that in relation to the 20 mile an hour limit role, you know, coming into force this week. Let's move on to more governancy related stuff. Here we go. Civil Society Alliance asks, could you comment on legislative consent motions, please? So, for instance, the rail bill enacted without consent from Scotland and Wales in the absence of a Northern Ireland Assembly. Technically speaking, the UK government didn't need consent, and is that correct? But the practical implications are significant, especially in terms of intergovernmental relations. And that won't be the only example. One of my favourite IFG graphs, and I do have favourites, is the number and size and frequency of LCM happening since, in particular, 2016 and the Brexit vote, and the comments around how they're happening on much bigger issues rather than just smaller lines within bills.
Okay, so first of all, Thanks. I'm glad you like that chart. I think it's a bit out of date. It's a good reminder that
There's
we
another bit of
probably.
homework for you, Akash.
Yeah. Well, actually, I think possibly a couple of the guys from the team are watching. So if you are guys, add that to the list. We should update that chart. But yeah, I mean, on the core point. So well, the rail bill, when you say, technically, did not require consent. So I haven't looked in detail at that one. I thought, well, it depends what you mean. I mean, there's a sort of obvious constitutional point whereby the whole Sewell Convention, LCM process is, well, it's a convention, it's not binding, and the UK government, and it's expressed in terms of what normally happens. Like that's the actual phrase, obviously. UK Parliament will not normally legislate
Which is
without consent.
problematic, isn't
Well, yeah, I mean, sure, and again, it's something that the commission's thinking about what you could do about. So, in that sense, the UK government, has argued on several of the recent occasions since 2016, as you say, Oriol, where there's been legislation without consent, that they didn't require it because the situation was not normal. Brexit was a not normal circumstance. They had to get it through initially. That was the first time it happened on the EU Withdrawal Act, or that was the first major example. And then there's been various sort of Brexit related legislation, but sometimes I think the UK government has very much stretched that definition. So it passed the UK Internal Markets Act without consent, of course, for many of the devolved legislatures. And again, they just sort of talked about it as it's a sort of necessary element of implementing Brexit, but that's
And there's
questionable.
quite a lot of stuff that's come from that, obviously, in relation to, for instance, Levelling Up Fund, Shared
Yeah,
Prosperity,
I 100%
and
agree. So
all of the stuff that that's created.
they've absolutely stretched it. But with the rail bill, sorry, I don't know. I mean, what normally happens though, you who's asking this question may be aware, but the UK government does their own analysis, and it's always published in the explanatory notes to a bill. So you can find that on the Parliament website. And basically there's a table of each section of the bill, whether or not consent is required or should be sought. With the rail bill, I don't know what the UK government concluded on it. But sometimes anyway, the UK government conclude one thing and the devolved governments conclude another, and then that's another thing where there's no mechanism for resolving that. Then, Westminster can just say, well, this is our legal advice that this does not relate to devolved areas, so we're just going to get on with it and ignore the devolved view. So it is problematic, I agree.
Let's move to the last question
Sure.
from Charles Whitmore from the Wales Government Centre. So I asked a question about what's changed, and your work, Akash, has really helpfully looked at the formal differences and the devolution. But do you have any thoughts about how devolution is changing because of practice, policy, and legislation that aren't necessarily headlined as constitutional or having a significant impact on devolution? So the example Charles gives is historic use of Section 35 of the Scotland Act, which you'll need to explain for the rest of us, and how this projects quite a strong policing by the UK government of that unclear border between devolved and non-devolved matters, and also UK Internal Markets Act and possible chilling effect on devolution, for instance.
No, that's a good question. I mean, I think so. We were just talking about Sewell, Legislative Consent Convention. I mean, that's a good illustration of, because of the nature of parliamentary sovereignty and the wider kind of sort of powers that UK government have. I'll say something specifically about Section 35 in a sec. It does mean that, a lot of how devolution operates in practice comes down to just how UK government chooses to act and chooses to engage with or treat how it chooses to treat devolution and the devolved institutions. And we have absolutely seen a shift post-Brexit, you might say, particularly post 2019. It was, muscular unionism as a strategy favoured particularly by Boris Johnson, hasn't necessarily been quite so prominent under Rishi Sunak, but I don't think fundamentally anything has changed. So yeah, I mean, what have we seen? We've seen that willingness, as I've already talked about, to legislate in devolved areas, sometimes, yeah, explicitly to kind of take on new powers to spend money and on devolved functions, like through the Shared Prosperity and Levelling Up funds, absolutely, and other things as well. I spotted a weird fund that DCMS has set up to fund football pitches all across the UK. And it's like, great, you know, I play football, let's have more football pitches by all means. But it strikes me as an odd thing for civil servants and ministers in the Department of Culture, Media and Sport in London to be deciding which bits of, you know, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, or indeed at the local level in England, should, you know, where we need a new five-a-side pitch or some new football goals built or whatever. Anyway, so that's the kind of thing that is happening, and it's driven by this calculation that holding the union together requires a more assertive, more active activity,
presence
yeah, and profile of the UK government and the UK state. And then in terms of just this week, Section 35 case, so actually, again, colleague of mine who hopefully is watching is writing an explainer on this case for the website, so that might go up soon. But what's happened with that is that was a section of the Scotland Act 1998 that gave UK ministers the ability to block devolved legislation. There's a similar provision for Wales as well. If ministers were convinced or had reasonable reason to believe that that legislation would have an adverse effect on the operation of UK-wide matters. So in this case, it was the Scottish Gender Recognition Reform Act or Bill that was deemed to have a negative effect on the Equalities Act. And they've chosen to use this power to block the legislation. It's obviously, it's in court this week. We'll see what happens. In a nutshell, we've definitely seen a change in UK government approach to devolution and the union, and that has had a material effect on devolved autonomy in a few areas, I would say.
Yeah. Ankash, thank you very much indeed. Peter Hugh Jenkins' last question is, normality isn't a legally regulated term, though. We're going to have to leave that for another time.
No, right? That's a problem.
Peter, thank you very much indeed. And it's midday, so it's time to draw things to a close. Diolch yn fawr iawn, thank you very much indeed, Akash, for joining us today and for being put on the spot by some very good questions.
Absolutely.
Typically engaged IWA audience. Thanks to all of you as well for joining us and contributing to the discussion. Our thanks also to the Legal Education Foundation once again for supporting our work on Wales's constitutional future and helping us to unpick these quite complex issues and questions for a wider audience. Our aim in these open and free events is always to identify issues that need further thought, articulate what they are, get people thinking about what needs to change, why particularly, and also how. It's got to be practical or realistic, and so that we can all play our part in making Wales better, which is the IWA's mission. And if you want to receive early notifications of future IWA events and recordings of all of our sessions straight into your inbox, which probably aren't full enough of them as they are, without having to go and look for them, please do join us as a member on the supporters page of our website. Thank you very much indeed, Diolch yn fawr iawn. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot. Bye.